Hi, this is Mark DeClive Lowe, and you're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. This morning, we will hear from journalist Shahan Mufti about his new book, American Caliph, about an incident in the 1970s that you probably didn't know about, ahead of him speaking at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy on Thursday, December 1st. We'll also hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all starts after Jason Martin's song, and it's time for the WGXC local news on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Controlled on air, in air, channel connection, and the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network, network.
On Wednesday, November 30th, Lex Gray and the Urban Pioneers from Catskill celebrate the release of their new single, I Believe in You, from the album How Many Roads, performing at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock. That's Wednesday, November 30th at 8 p.m. at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock. Lex Gray and her Urban Pioneers band that usually features Sonny Rock, Ed Wiliski, Brian DeWan, and Tim Farrell. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org for more information about this show and many others.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC local news for Wednesday, November 30th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Roger Hannigan-Gilson reports for the Times-Union that the trial of four people charged with unlawful imprisonment and assault for the alleged 2020 beating of local mechanic Harold Handy was abruptly adjourned November 28th after a private discussion between the judge and the district attorney prosecuting the case. Columbia County Judge Richard Kowiek's decision was made without any input from defense counsel. The matter is now unlikely to go to trial before next year. Neither Kowiek nor DA Paul Chaika would speak afterward about the circumstances that led to the private confab or what prompted it. The four defendants, Columbia County Sheriff's Deputy Kelly Rosenstrocht, her husband, business person Alex Rosenstrocht, IRS agent Brian Hogg, and local contractor Corey Gaylord, were indicted on gang assault charges following an incident in the Rosenstrocht home in the early morning hours of July 5, 2020. The top charges, carrying a potential for lengthy prison terms, were dismissed by Kowiek in December. Gaylord's attorney, Stephen Coffey, said the adjournment followed a request by Chaika for a private discussion between himself and the judge. Quote, they talked for about 20 minutes, and then the judge came out and said that the case was now adjourned. Did not give a reason, except he said, quote, this was pursuant to my discussion with Mr. Chaika, unquote. quote, Coffee said. The reasoning for the adjournment was sealed by the court, according to Coffee. Handy's personal counsel, Paul Freeman, said his office was trying to figure out why the case was adjourned. Quote, we were told the determination to adjourn for whatever reason is sealed, so they are not releasing the rationale or reasons, unquote, he said. Hogg's attorney, Paul D. Rowe Hansen, the second, plans to make a motion to unseal the minutes of the ex parte communication, quote, to get more insight, unquote, into why the decision was made, he said. But it would be up to COEEC whether to grant the motion. It is also up to the judge's discretion whether to make the minutes publicly available or only available to the defense. Neither Chaika or COEEC responded to inquiries. A new trial date has not been set, but there is a conference on the schedule for February. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that the Article 78 proceeding that alleged the Caro Town Board wrongly awarded federal grant money to the Caro Development Foundation has been dismissed. On November 28th, Acting State Supreme Court Justice Adam Silverman ruled the lawsuit initiated by Mountain View Enterprises and Caro resident Emmy Cross was filed 11 days past the state's four-month statute of limitations. Quote, the alleged facts of this case are unusual and concerning, unquote, Silverman wrote to begin his eight-page decision. Quote, the petition is dismissed because the resolution being challenged became final and binding more than 4 months prior to the commencement of this special proceeding, unquote, he ruled. The case stems from the town board's March 7th vote to release U.S. Housing and Urban Development residential rehabilitation grant funds that sat idle in the town coffers for decades. Three applicants, Cross, Mountain View Enterprises, and the Caro Development Fund, were awarded funds, but not in the amounts approved by Delaware Engineering. Catskill attorney Monica Kenny Keff initiated the proceedings in state Supreme Court, arguing the board's resolution was, quote, unlawful, arbitrary, and capricious, and as a result of their personal conflicts of interest and personal and political interests with respects to the CDF, unquote. The complainants asked the court to issue a preliminary injunction against the defendants to stop disbursement of the grant funds and order the money be distributed as originally recommended by Delaware Engineering. The original HUD grant was in the amount of $400,000 and awarded to the town in 1988 for distribution to low-income residents of Caro. In 2015, then-Supervisor Ted Banta found there was still approximately $60,000 left in the pot. According to an August 3, 2015 town board meeting minutes, those funds were to be distributed to more than 20 candidates who applied for the funding, but that never happened. Silverman wrote in his decision, quote, nearly a quarter century after the funds were first obtained and 7 years after they were mysteriously discovered, the parties agree that these funds have yet to be dispersed for their intended purpose. Regardless of the outcome of this case, it remains clear that the low to moderate income residents who were intended to benefit from these funds have suffered an unexplained and seemingly unreasonable delay, unquote, Silverman added. Read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. Mid-Hudson News reports that State Senator Michelle Hinchey's legislation to expand eligibility under the New York State Young Farmers Loan Forgiveness Incentive Program has been signed into law by Governor Kathy Hochul. The measure helps alleviate a student debt burden by providing grant awards for individuals who earn an undergraduate degree from a New York State college or university and plan to pursue a career in farming. Eligibility for the program was previously contingent on the applicant having graduated from college within the previous 2 years. Hinchey's bill removes that eligibility requirement, replacing it with the qualification that an applicant must not have previously farmed for more than 10 consecutive years. Hinchey said the new law makes it more reasonable for young people to start a career in farming while having more money in the bank to invest in their businesses. Read more about this story at midhudsonnews.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Early Electromix is a series to document the history of experimental electronic music from the 50s to the 80s. Pioneers who paved the way for what was to become techno, ambient, electronica, and most of what we are listening to. Essential Culture on air every Tuesday from 11 to 12 a.m.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, November 30th. Local early morning temperatures range from 29 degrees in Voorheesville to 39 in Copaic. Regional average soil temperature is 40 degrees. snow should fly locally today. A slow, steady rise in temperature will help keep it brief this morning before becoming all rain by 11 a.m. A high of 44 happens at 3 p.m., but you're not going to notice it because the winds get pretty gusty this afternoon, reaching around 45 miles per hour. Overnight, rain turns to snow as temperatures lower to 24 degrees. Half inch of white stuff could build up. Tomorrow, not so nice either. Snow chances end by noon, but we get a high of only 29 and wind gusts in the upper 30s will keep conditions thoroughly sub-freezing. Protect any exposed skin. Little dip to 23 degrees overnight takes us into a warming Friday with a high of 35. Saturday gets warmer, hitting 43 degrees, but that brings the rain on back to the area. Sunset today will be at 4:12 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7 o'clock a.m. Looking way up, we see, even though we are still waiting for that solar wind to arrive, things are currently quieting down with the aurora oval retreating to northern Canada. Solar wind speed is currently 606 kilometers per second at 2.4 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty bad till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KPNX is 4.6, unsettled. The current sunspot number is 25. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Randall and Bernadette Martin of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio Program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Acra or anytime at WGXC.org.
Now, from Survive All comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survive All shelter today.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We are not pushing this legislation to make history. We are doing this to make a difference for millions upon millions of Americans. It's a historic day, but it's going to make a difference.
Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin celebrated the Senate's passage of the Respect for Marriage Act, which would ensure same-sex and interracial marriages are enshrined into federal law. The bill, which passed in a 61-36 vote, includes protections for religious liberties, such as exempting businesses from providing services to couples, and was supported by 12 Republicans, including Senator Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming.
For the sake of our nation today and its survival, we do well by taking this step.
The bill now returns to the House, where Democrats remain in control for the rest of the legislative session. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress will take up legislation this week to prevent a threatened nationwide railroad strike.
We must avoid a strike. Jobs will be lost, even union jobs will be lost. Water will not be safe. Product will not be going to market. And we could lose 750,000 jobs, some of them union jobs. That must be avoided.
The move comes ahead of a December 9th strike deadline. Four of 12 rail unions lack a contract, including one union which rejected a tentative deal negotiated with help from the Biden administration. Union leaders were angered by lawmakers' decision to force adoption of an agreement which does not address paid sick leave for workers. A federal jury found Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes guilty of seditious conspiracy for plotting to prevent the peaceful transfer of power following the 2020 presidential election, leading to the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti joined 70 other mayors from across the U.S. in asking Congress to fast-track immigration protections for so-called Dreamers, or undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as minors.
So we say clearly to Washington, pass the DREAM Act once and for all right now.
The mayor's fear a possible Supreme Court decision could invalidate the DACA program, making hundreds of thousands of young adults subject to deportation. The mother of one of the victims in the Uvalde, Texas elementary school shooting has filed a federal lawsuit against gun manufacturer Daniel Defense for negligently using militaristic imagery to lure young people to purchase their guns. Finally, Twitter says it will no longer stop users from sharing false information regarding COVID-19. Company policies against misinformation on the virus led to more than 11,000 account suspensions prior to the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Yesterday, we reported on the two states which use runoffs in their elections, including Georgia, which has a U.S. Senate runoff on December 6th, and Louisiana for local elections and 3 ballot measures on December 10th. But did you know that runoffs are also used to determine party nominees in some states? Ballotpedia reports that 10 states use top 2 runoffs for primaries: Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas use runoff elections when no candidate has a 50% plus one vote majority to determine the party nominee going into the general election. In North Carolina, a candidate must receive 30% to win a primary. In South Dakota, runoffs are used for partisan primaries for congressional or gubernatorial seats when no candidate receives 35%. And in Vermont, runoffs are only used when a tie occurs. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, primary runoff systems developed in the South to encourage candidates to broaden their appeal so extreme candidates would be less likely to get elected. In Arkansas, runoffs were used to prevent members of the Ku Klux Klan from getting elected with small pluralities in lower turnout primaries. Another form of runoff, called an instant runoff or ranked choice voting, is being implemented in some states around the country. More on that tomorrow. We have links to articles and resources at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
Next, we hear from Pylon, the Athens, Georgia band that came of age after the B-52s became famous and before REM did. This is probably their best-known song, which because REM covered it. This is Pylon and Crazy.
The sun
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
My name is Steve Pierce, correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm joined by Shahan Mufti, longtime journalist, head of the journalism department at the University of Richmond, and author of the new book, American Caliph, about the 1977 Hanafi Muslim siege of Washington, D.C. Shahan, welcome. Can you give us a brief overview of what happened back then and why?
Well, at the center of my book are two full days from March 9th, actually into the morning of March 11th of 1977. These were three crazy days in the history of America that have been amazingly forgotten by many, by most. This was a hostage taking that took place in Washington, D.C. on the morning of March 9th. 12 members of the Hanafi group, a group of mostly African-American Muslims headquartered in Washington, D.C., just a few miles up the road from the White House, took over three different locations in Washington, D.C., and took close to 150 hostages in the city that morning. Seven of them went to the B'nai B'rith headquarters, which is the largest Jewish services organization in the country, actually, and the oldest. A few others went to the Islamic Center on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C., which is at that time was definitely the largest, most important mosque, Islamic mosque in the country. Took about a dozen hostages there. And then two other Hanafis, they landed in the district building, which is just a couple hundred yards from the White House, actually visible from the White House. And those three men took about another dozen hostages in the district building. That location was the most violent, where shots were fired. There was a firefight between security, police, and the Hanafi hostage takers. And that's where the first casualties that morning happened. Speaking of the White House, this was early days for the Carter administration. So Jimmy Carter had been in office not even 2 months at this point. And he was quickly considering all that was happening in that city and how close it was to the White House. The federal government and the White House were quickly involved in that. And Carter was actually busy that day hosting the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, and they were having some heated exchanges about the 1967 borders that Israel would have to return to. And some Middle Eastern politics was in Washington that morning in more than one way.
I should, in the interest of full disclosure, tell you that, and our listeners, that I have a personal stake in the story. I was 18 years old at the time. My father was an intern in the district building in D.C., and he was caught up in all of this and actually severely wounded. He'd lived a life after the incident in a wheelchair, triplegic because of a gunshot wound that was suffered as part of the shooting that you referred to. That's how I got interested in the story. The story got interested in me. How did you get interested in the story?
In a roundabout way. My interest, as I actually did not know about this story, like so many people that in your audience that are hearing this for the first time, I had never heard of this until about 7 years ago when I found it. I found it kind of a roundabout way. I was there was the attack in Paris, France, on the Charlie Hebdo offices in 2015 by a couple of French Muslim men, and they had attacked the Charlie Hebdo. It was a satirical publication in France, and they'd attacked those offices because they had published some cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Anyway, I mean, I was kind of shaken by that event, and I found myself thinking about it a lot, that attack on that newsroom. And there was a lot of almost half that editorial team died and was murdered that day. And it was something that got me thinking about this issue. And I had been long thinking about this larger recurring issue of violence that happens around this idea of protecting the Islamic prophet's honor and memory and image. And, you know, all the way from the satanic verses in the 80s to all the way until, well, Salman Rushdie was just attacked on stage again. And in between, we've had the Danish cartoons. We've had the YouTube video that led to the, that when part was in the middle of the Arab Spring, there's South Park episodes. I mean, there's been so much. This keeps happening. I had long been paying attention to this. And that's when I started looking into it. And I just found this as a kind of a throwaway paragraph in an academic study while I was reading up on the issue about this takeover in downtown Washington by 12 Muslim men and 150. And I could not believe what I was reading because I couldn't believe that I didn't know anything about it. I had never heard anything about it. And I was even more amazed when I found that nobody had actually written about it. And there was no real record of what had occurred in at least in book form or in any kind of long form. So that as a reporter, as a journalist, as a author, as a person who writes books, that was it. That I knew in that moment that this is something I had to write about. And I had no idea really the what I was getting into and the layers I would have to peel back. But I got started on that pretty immediately. And that was 7 years ago almost now.
I've always wondered why it hadn't been turned into a movie, a Hollywood movie, because it has all the elements. You have, you know, violence, you have all the action movie things. The only thing I think you really don't have a lot of is sex, and you even have Elizabeth Taylor in tangentially, so I guess you could.
And a crazy cast of characters. That's the thing is that, I mean, it's just amazing. In the beginning, like when I started writing the book, I did not know, I could not imagine the cast of characters I would encounter. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA star, central to this story. Elizabeth Taylor is in the mix. Malcolm X is an important character, especially in the first half of the story. We have, Amiri Baraka makes an appearance. Marion Barry is shot in Washington, D.C., who went on to become the mayor of Washington forever. Muammar Gaddafi, I would say, is a central, pivotal character, the Libyan dictator. Anthony Quinn is in there. I mean, I could keep going, and it sounds crazy when you list them in this order. How could all these people possibly be connected? But they are, and that's what that is what I think was really, this is a rich story, and it just, all these characters are coming in from different parts of American culture and society and global culture and society. And that's what I think really made this story interesting for me. But beyond the action and the kind of recreating of important events, it was just the ramifications of all that and the roots of all that was happening as well. Is this was a, it just had it was a really textured, layered story to work on, and part that's why it took a long time. But I think that's also why it was a very satisfying story to write.
Have you had any inquiries about film rights for the book?
I think so. I'm trying to keep my head clear of that stuff. My agent is dealing with that, but yes, there is obviously. I mean, I think now that the story's been written, and Steve, like we were talking about, I mean, people did not really this since this had never been written about. People didn't really, I think, appreciate the richness of the story. But I think now that it's in book form, I think people in the visual medium are definitely, I assume, going to be interested. I think it would make a great movie or a series or limited series or something.
Yeah. Well, most of the work's been done now. So,
Yeah, it's just got to get cameras now.
The first time I heard about the book was when you received a grant to do the research on it. Wow. And I thought, fantastic. You know, finally, somebody's researching the roots and branches of the story, which are just kind of overwhelming, the amount of information that's in there if you dig deeply enough. I was worried when I saw the first signs of the book's publication, because it's called American Caliph, the true story of a Muslim mystic, a Hollywood epic, and the 1977 siege of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true, but it feels a little sensationalistic. And I thought, oh, no, not another one of these. And then I started reading, and I was just really, it was breathtaking the amount of detail that you have in here, tracing the story around the world. And it struck me that today's standards of journalism And probably even back in those days, because if you look at the archival video, which there's quite a bit, you see that there's a huge amount of information about what happened, but nothing about why.
Yeah.
And after almost 50 years, there's still almost nothing about why until your book came out. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Shahan Mufti, journalist, head of the journalism department at the University of Richmond, and author of the new book, American Caliph, about the 1977 Hanafi Muslim siege of Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
It's all right if you rob me. It's all right if you don't. I know I played low, you ran in our way, honey. I got that feeling you want. There is no sense in remain. You're right here, you're away. We said all this to say. Leave it, break down, go ahead and give me. Break down, honey, take me to the lane. Break down.
alright if you don't. I'm not afraid of you running away, honey. I get the feeling you won't. There is no use in pretending. Your eyes give you away. Something inside you is feeling like I do. We said all is to say. Baby, go ahead and give it to me. Break down, I wanna take me through the night. Break down, not standing here, can't you see? Break down, it's alright. It's alright. To me. Break down, honey, take me through the night. Break down, can't you see? Break down, it's alright. It's alright. Ooh, it's alright.
We'll be right back.
happen again, it will be. Though the course may change sometimes, rivers always reach the sea. That's all right with me. In the midst, I think of you and how it used to be.
Just the first time.